The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Kurt Benrood from the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Sci-Fi. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from Daily Sci-Fi.
Hi, I'm Tom Atkinson, and I'm going to be reading Buried in Sand by Andy Rogers. Charlie let the temporal freeze come instantly. The slowing of time was instinctual now. He'd had months in the sanitarium to perfect it. He flipped it on like a light switch as soon as he heard the gunshot. The gun was pointed at Megan. Had he not slowed time, the bullet would have already entered her torso. As it was, he could see the bullet hanging in midair. Megan was more than just a nurse. She was a gift from the outside. She brought light and normalcy into the sanitarium's stale environment, smiling, lovely, and unpatronizing. Charlie was smitten the first day she'd said hello. "Hey, Chuck, what a great breakfast this morning, right? I assume you've already taken your meds." She assumed the best of him. How cool was that? And she called him Chuck. She just had to believe him, even if no one else did. "You know, the doc will be upset if you skip them again." The doctor was just like everyone at school. No one had believed him, not even his advisor. Didn't it matter that he'd earned a full scholarship for temporal physics? Didn't his overwhelming test scores buy some credibility? "You were brought into this program to make new discoveries about time and space," his advisor snapped. "Not waste your genius on impossible theories. You simply cannot stop time as you described. You would contradict proven laws of nature." The mistake Charlie made that day was to assert that he could stop time. Weeks after he had been moved to the sanitarium, he realized that he wasn't stopping time at all. He was only slowing it down. Or at least he was observing it pass infinitesimally slowly. Did that mean he was speeding up? He wasn't sure. All he knew was that he could observe time pass so slowly it was nearly impossible to detect. The bullet fired at Megan seemed frozen in place, though Charlie knew it moved ever closer along its trajectory. He couldn't understand why Megan had ever dated Jake. "Leave me and you'll regret it," Jake threatened one night. Charlie heard him yelling in the parking lot. Megan was crying. "Thanks, Chuck, but don't worry about it," she said the next day. "It's best for you not to get stressed. Jake won't be back." Yet there he was, in the sanitarium, firing a weapon at the only person who believed him. He had told her before how everything worked. She listened without skepticism. "Do you have super speed?" she asked. "Can you grab a bullet out of the air like Neo?" "I know that's how it always happens in the movies, but I'm not like Neo. I can't do stuff in the blink of an eye. All I can do is observe time pass and try to move a little bit faster than that. It is exhausting, actually, like trying to move your arms when you're buried in sand." "What good is it then?" Charlie couldn't answer that question. "Sounds lonely, Chuck." Megan didn't know how right she was. Charlie might not be able to stop this bullet from hitting her, but for however long he could, he would let it hang there, keeping her alive, straining for movement.
My name is Renita Banerjee, and the story I'm about to read is titled An Averted Tragedy by Brian Jean Olson. Mr. Kappen's Comparative World Literature Class, Quiz 1, Points Possible 50, Name Amanda McWilliams. Question 1, 5 points. Our class recently took a field trip to two alternate universes in which two of our world's most famous literary characters really exist. To travel to these universes, we A. quantum phased, B. quantum teleported, C. quantum transported, D. quantum wibble wobbled. Your answer: B. Score 5. Teacher comments: none. Question 2, 5 points. Why is it important for our class to be quantum cloaked whenever we travel the multiverse? Your answer: so the people there don't see us. Score 1. Teacher comments: your answer is incomplete. We must be quantum cloaked so that none of the people we observe can see, hear, smell, touch, or taste us. And just as important, so that we don't interact in any way with other multiverse travelers or with ourselves if and when we return to the same universe to observe the same event. Question 3, 5 points. Which two tragic heroes did we observe? A. Sophocles Achilles and Shakespeare's Hamlet. B. Sophocles Ajax and Shakespeare's Macbeth. C. Euripides Ajax and Shakespeare's Hamlet. D. Sophocles Ajax and Shakespeare's Hamlet. Your answer: D. Score 5. Teacher comments: none. Question 4, 5 points. What happens to people when we quantum swap them? A. Each person retains his or her original memories and personality. B. Each person retains his or her original memories but takes on the other's personality. C. Each person takes on the other's memories but retains his or her original personality. D. Each person takes on the other's memories and personality. Your answer: C. Score 5. Teacher comments: none. Question 5, 5 points. Why did we quantum swap our two tragic heroes? Your answer: so we could see how different they are in the different universes. Score 3. Teacher comments: more specifically, we quantum swap tragic heroes so we can observe to what degree the environment itself, the tragic hero's world, makes that person tragic, as well as to discover to what extent each hero is a reflection of the aesthetic quality of his universe. Question 6, 5 points. What happened to the tragic heroes in their respective original timelines before we quantum swapped them? Be specific. Your answer: Ajax committed suicide because he lost a debate with Odysseus about who got to keep Achilles' armor. Hamlet missed his opportunity to kill Claudius, accidentally killed Polonius, and later died in a duel with Polonius' son, Laertes. Score 5. Teacher comments: none. Question 7, 5 points. What happened to the tragic heroes after we quantum swapped them? Your answer: Hamlet convinced Lord Agamemnon to give him a rematch with Odysseus. A crowd of soldiers gathered around to hear what Hamlet slash Ajax had to say now, but none of them expected what was about to happen. Hamlet gave his "to be or not to be" soliloquy, and the crowd went silent. Odysseus just stood there with his mouth open, but he couldn't speak. Then he started to shout about some god betraying Athena and helping Ajax. I guess that god was us. By unanimous decision, Hamlet won the armor. Odysseus was furious, but then he and Hamlet had a friendly debate and seemed to become friendly with each other. Meanwhile, in the other universe, Ajax walked in on King Claudius, kneeling and praying, and in one quick motion, Ajax sliced the king's head off. Then he killed Polonius and fled the castle. He joined up with Fortinbras's army and marched with them as they conquered the land. Score 5. Teacher comments: good observations. Question 8, 5 points. In your opinion, were the quantum swapped heroes still tragic in character? Answer should be at least 50 words. Your answer. No, because each man found a piece in the other's universe which had eluded him in his own. Hamlet was up to the challenge that Ajax had faced, and Ajax was just the avenging hero that the ghost of Hamlet's father had demanded him to be. Both men lived happily ever after in their new universes, until we swapped them again. Score 5. Teacher comments, none. Question 9. 5 points. Why did we quantum swap the heroes back to their own universes and restore their original timelines before we quantum teleported ourselves back to the lecture hall in our own world? A. Because we are cruel. B. Because we like watching people suffer. C. They were much happier in their original universes. D. It's the law. Your answer, D. Score, 5. Teacher comments, none. Question 10, 5 points. How did you feel seeing these tragic heroes in life? Did you experience what Aristotle called the tragic emotions of pity and terror? Your answer. Mostly I was just sad for them, even when they were happy in their new situations, because I knew we would have to send them back to their own universes where they felt they didn't belong. It made me cry. Score 5. Teacher comments, none. Extra credit question, 2 points. What was it Polonius shouted after he witnessed Ajax cutting the king's head off? Your answer. What? Ho! Help! 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 Score 2. Total score, 46 points. 92% A.
Hey, I got a B. Amanda, what did you get?
An A. I almost got a B, but that extra credit question saved me.
Tragedy averted. I'm Kurt Benrud. This is An Amateur's Guide to Time Travel by Marianne Rosarum. Editor's note, this is a work of fiction. Please don't attempt time travel in this way. The best way to time travel is to fall. You must be brave. Jumping from a swing or down the last 3 steps on a stairwell will only take you back a few seconds. You may have the sense that you've been here in this moment before, but you will dismiss the feeling and go about your day as if nothing extraordinary happened. A bridge is, by far, the best tool at your disposal. The drop is much further than any mere window ledge has to offer. The more momentum you build as you plummet, the more years will slip between your fingers like rainwater. More importantly, you must have faith that your bones will remain unbroken when you jump. But you must also be prepared for your heart to shatter with the force of the impact. You see, time travelers often have broken hearts, or no hearts at all. You cannot walk through history and remain untouched by wars, disease, random acts of human kindness, and cruelty. Do not worry. Time travelers have long since forgotten how to cry. Time travelers do not make good lovers, but it is only natural that you should want companionship. You are still somewhat human. The first lover will be a girl, the strength of her city fading as enemy tanks creep towards it, their process slowed only by the harsh winter winds. You will be captivated by the snowflakes collecting on her flushed cheeks, each as bright as the promises she makes to you. You do not understand that the red star stitched on her cap is the same shape as the bullet wound that will soon steal her from you. Your second lover will pull you onto the dance floor without warning, his dark hand engulfing yours. You will be drunk on forbidden gin and the impossibility of your own survival.
You have come through a siege now, and want to be closer to the living than to the dead that night. He will gladly comply. You will have 100 other affairs. Some will be consummated centuries from home amid unfamiliar sheets that smell of cardamom and sunburnt skin. But many infatuations will never move beyond longing gazes exchanged between greasy playing cards and cups of strong, steaming tea. You will marry once. You will regret it later. You must not blame yourself. Time travelers do not always know their own futures. Time travelers are excellent catalysts. You will give poets their first lines and playwrights their finest characters. You will rouse dreamers from their apathy and send them onwards toward the crown and the noose alike with a kiss. You will occasionally say something profound and be recorded. Decline to be quoted by name. Anonymity is its own power. You will make at least one ill-advised attempt to kill Hitler. Do not feel guilty when you fail. Remember, you would have felt worse if you had not tried. You will leave offerings for Ereshkigal and Persephone and Loki and learn all the names of the singular Godhead. You will lose them, just as you lost the girl with the red star and the boy who taught you to dance. Religion is difficult to master for the solitary, and you are too afraid of being worshipped yourself if you accidentally speak of the things to come. You will measure the slow passage of your life in regime changes, and outlast languages, mourning them as if they too had been your lovers. You will watch stories twist into great and new things, including your own. You will learn to forget. As a time traveler, you must.
Hello, this is Robbie Merritt. I'm going to be reading The Seven Habits of Highly Effective Monsters by Alex Schwartzman. It isn't easy being green, scaly, or abominable these days. Humanity turned the tables on the apex predators of the food chain and has been exterminating us with extreme prejudice. We're still faster and stronger than they are, but we're prone to defeat by bad judgment. Heed the lessons of our vanquished brethren, learn from their mistakes, and remain successful, extant, and satiated. 1. Don't rely on henchmen. There's no denying that it's emotionally satisfying to be worshipped, or at least obeyed by humans. However, there's little practical benefit. In the entire history of henchmen, cultists, minions, lackeys, and worshippers, one is hard-pressed to come up with a single paragon of effectiveness. Instead, they tend to be slow, dim-witted, and clumsy. At best, your followers might mildly inconvenience your adversary as he or she rampages through your lair or secret laboratory, sharp object or destiny in hand. At worst, they might develop last-minute regrets and attempt to throw you down the nearest shaft. So, next time someone else asks if you're a god, just eat them. 2. Heed the warning signs. Ignoring the obvious means you're just asking for trouble. For example, vampires and other beings highly allergic to vitamin D are advised to steer clear of towns with the word sunny in their name. That's just common sense. There are plenty of better targets, places with names that evoke gothic dread and despair. Names like Glooming Creek, Murky Hollow, Gloomsburg, or Detroit. 3. Be aware of your surroundings. Don't climb skyscrapers. There's little room to maneuver up there, and the position isn't defensible. If your adversary is running away, they're almost certainly leading you into a trap. Pre-plan your retreat. Always know the shortest route to the nearest sewer, secret passage, or interdimensional portal. If retreat isn't an option, pretend to be their friend. A surprising number of humans will fall for a few sparkles and a tortured expression. 4. Practice safe invading. When invading alien planets, be sure that all your vaccinations are up to date. Your mothership's operating system shouldn't be compatible with the latest in Earth's computer virus technology. Whatever resources you seek on Earth, water, oxygen, landmass to terraform, are cheap and plentiful elsewhere in the universe. If you've achieved interstellar flight, your robots are probably safer, smarter, and longer lasting than human slave labor. 5. Mix it up. Adjust your tactics to keep your nemesis guessing. It's okay not to eat the lone black guy first. The rest of his party will never expect it if you start with someone else. Stab your adversary in the middle of explaining your nefarious plan to them. Don't place your calls from the inside the house. 6. Hunt safely. On average, few modern humans have access to the silver bullets, pitchforks, or wooden stakes soaked in holy water. And probably the odds of anyone who encounters a monster possessing such items rise exponentially. Always comport yourself as though everyone has access to the one thing that can pierce your otherwise indestructible skin or body armor. 7. Even if you meticulously prepare your schemes and pay careful attention to the safety tips above, at the end of the day, you must ask yourself, is it really worth it? The most dangerous monster of all is man. For best results, avoid encounters at all costs.
I'm Joanna LaForgia, and I'll be reading The Lies I've Told to Keep You Safe by Matt Dovey. I'm sure they're not a threat. Their ships probably need to be that big to travel so far across the stars and the spaces between. I don't mean them to look so dangerous. They must be friendly. You wouldn't be able to build such things if you couldn't work together as a society. Of course you're not a burden to me. You're my wife, and I love you just as much as the day we married. I stay because I want to. Yes, you're right. I can see how the ships look like the black skeletons of birds, burned and splayed across the sky. No, it makes sense. I just had to squint my eyes first to see it, that's all. We've not surrendered. It's an agreement to work together for the betterment of humanity. They're going to help prepare us for galactic civilization. They'll not make us leave home for the camps. I won't let them. We won't need to go. I know you couldn't manage without me. I need you, too. Really. You'll never be without me. I promise. The camps are for the best. It's just more efficient this way, and we need to learn to be a little more efficient for when we're out in space. We'll be looked after better in the camps. I promise. I know it doesn't look friendly with all that fencing and steel, stones underfoot and glaring light from the monitoring ship above, but they wouldn't want to harm us. We're working together. Just hold my hand and walk forward, and it will all be okay. They've not stolen Megan, no! She volunteered. I don't know where you heard that rumor of people being taken prisoner. She'll be fine. They've taken her to see their planet, like an exchange, that's all. She's living a better life now. Go back to sleep, my love, my lover. I can't hear any noises outside. You must be dreaming them. I'm not leaving you. I promise. I promise. I'm just going to visit Megan. I'll be back before you know it. You'll be fine without me. You'll be fine.
This is Steve Lord reading Paper Hearts by Lynette Mejia. The little girl holds the delicate tissue paper carefully between thin, soot-stained fingers. The scissors are old and dull, handles missing their plastic covers. Blisters have formed on her hands where they've pinched, though she barely notices. Pain is an old friend now, and besides, she doesn't mind the company. She works slowly, deliberately, tracing the shapes with the stub of a burned pencil before cutting them into small, wrinkled hearts. The translucent scraps pile around her feet like snow, and she smiles at the memory of winter. It was Valentine's Day when the world burned, when the paper hearts they'd been cutting were abandoned as the teachers screamed at them to crawl beneath the desks. Months now since she'd emerged coughing and vomiting from the burned-out hulk of the school, of the life she'd known before. No one at home, and no home to speak of, only the endless wandering, the hunger, the thirst. And then today she'd found a school again, and she knew it must be Valentine's Day, because lying there on the blackened floor was the bright softness of the tissue paper, clean, like fresh snow, good as new, as if it had been waiting patiently for her return. And so she'd smiled and begun to cut out the hearts, one for each of them. Mommy, Daddy, Miss Emma, Abby, Jayla, and the rest. Quiet and determined, she continues as the moon rises, shining bright through the cold rubble of the splintered roof, until the ghosts return, gathering around her, falling like snow, or fire, or paper hearts.
We've run out of time for today's episode of Sci-Fi. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Kurt Benrud, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Sci-Fi is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.